Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing?
How's it, Nick? Not doing too bad.
Very good. And of course, Sargon. Sar, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Right, so let us get stuck into the news of today. And we start off with something that has been called on social media the Phoenix Massacre. And I think the details of what exactly happened in Phoenix during the looting is still a little bit unclear. But there have been lots of videos posted around on social media purportedly showing Indian people shooting black people or beating black people or things like that. And this has been a lot of these, we don't really know the context or what's going on or who's being shot or whatever. And some people are now facing charges relating to vigilantism. But for the most part, I think the details are still unclear. Unfortunately, however, while the court cases go on, all of the nasty race hustlers and awful racists are coming out, including a chap known as Jackie Shandu, who used to be in the EFF, but had a falling out with him at some point. So Jackie Shandu, who's been calling himself a convener of a coalition of civic groups who are calling themselves the hashtag Justice for Phoenix Massacre Victims, has been arrested for inciting public violence and racial hatred. He handed himself over to cops yesterday because last week, while in front of the court, he began chanting, "One settler, one bullet, one Indian, one bullet," to a gathering. Who then repeats the remarks. The apparently his real name, according to the state, is Gift Hadebe, which is quite interesting that he actually has this pen name.
Namdege.
Yes, yes. And yeah, so he's been charged, and he later said on Twitter, I think on Friday, that he made some quote problematic remarks, which, with the benefit of hindsight, I should not have said. I said one settler, one bullet, one Indian, one bullet. I want to withdraw those remarks because I don't condone violence and I see the potential that they have to sort of inflame already existing racial tensions. Well, Sarah, what do you make of this?
You know, racial tensions between Indians and blacks in Natal is long-standing, and it's probably based on a range of cliches about sort of Indians being comparatively successful running stores. It's very much they're very much family businesses, and employing young blacks from the area, not paying them that well, not treating them that well. So it's that mix of stereotypes that is as old as the day is long. What's interesting about Shandu is, one is, I don't know if this is a lack of courage, but is the sort of extent of the apology, because from what we spoke about off air, he's been at this for some years. And what it demonstrates also is that, you know, it's kind of very easy to hate. It's much easier to hate than to express positive feelings, because it's a visceral thing. It you can drum up people's enthusiasm, you can get them excited, you can rile them up. And I think this is often used as a sort of shortcut to leadership, Julius Malema being the obvious example of it. And I wonder whether one of the ways of dealing with this, considering he's sort of been apologetic and contrite, wouldn't be for someone sort of fairly influential in the Indian community to actually invite him, literally invite him for tea and start talking about it. Because it's something the representatives of the Jewish community have done very well with many of the people who've made public anti-Semitic remarks, is they've got them into talk. It's been polite, it's been informative. They've taken them to the Holocaust Museum, which is always informative. And often it completely changes a perspective on it, and partly because of what you learn and partly because you actually see that the people you belittling and saying nasty things about are actually nice, good people. And it becomes difficult to sustain the hatred. As I say, hatred's an easy emotion to... pleasant emotions aren't able to last as long, let's put it that way.
So what's also been quite interesting about this is the way that different political groups have reacted to the things going on in KZN. So, of course, the ANC, there was I think we covered it on the show, a poster going around saying we need to resist these racist Indians because the state is allowing Indians to shoot our people. That was, I think, message coming out with ANC branding. The ANC in eThekwini rejected that and said that it was fake and it's got nothing to do with them. I think what's more likely the truth is that there are some branches of the ANC that were pushing that message while others were resisting it. But the EFF is now getting itself, of course, into the mix because they can't stay away from racial tension. And there is a poster that they've tweeted out from the eThekwini region, which says, "March to Phoenix against racist Indians. Thursday, 5th of August, meeting point, Gundy Park." Morris, what do you make of the political dimension of all this?
Well, it's not very surprising. I mean, the EFF have hardly been people who are fans of non-racialism. So, and also, as you pointed out, the irony of them marching or meeting at Gundy Park or whatever the case is also. But as Morris says, I mean, there have been tensions between Black South Africans and Indian South Africans isn't anything new. I mean, there were riots in the late 1940s where people, Zulus down in Durban, attacked Indian-owned businesses and so on. And at the time, there were some rumors that actually white people had been instigators and had encouraged the Black South Africans to attack Indian South Africans and whatever you. And I remember reading in an article, it said something that would actually create 30,000 refugees. It was actually quite something. But yeah, but I mean, these kind of grievances go back a long time. And it's not good that we have people like, well, not good, that's been my understatement. It's not great with people like Jackie Shandu and EFF, saying this kind of anti-Indian bigotry. And from what I've seen, there's been no proof that people were attacked for being black in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen some videos where there did seem to be a racial element, but I've seen far more where people of different races were standing together to protect their homes and their property and so on. I haven't seen anything where you can actually say that there were black people in Phoenix attacked for being black and that they were killed and so on. So, I mean, I think a lot of what's happened last month is still going to come through. And we're going to, I think once the smoke is cleared and whatever, we'll find out exactly what happened. But I think a lot will still, we just won't know what happened. But I really don't think that there were Indian militias or gangs roaming Phoenix looking for black people to kill. It just doesn't seem like something. I'd need to get some evidence of that. I'm not going to believe somebody like Jackie Bandu or, members of the EFF KwaZulu-Natal.
And that has been the narrative that's been pushed on social media by some of these groups, that there was racially targeted violence by Indians against black people. And also in the pages of other publications, I think you said that you read something recently, Morris?
Yeah, there was an article on EWN published by a guy called Yonelo Biko, and some people might recognize the name. He's written for Daily Maverick before. He used to be a ministerial spokesperson in the Water and Sanitation Department, I think. He also caused a little bit of controversy a little while ago. It turned out one of his op-eds he'd written for the Daily Maverick had been plagiarized. Mm. But this op-ed now written for EWN, it's quite something. I'll read an extract here. So it says, "There were brutal scenes of Indian groupings in Phoenix, driving around, carrying weapons of war, looking for anyone with a black skin, with the aim being to punish and inflict pain. Not on the perpetrators themselves, but on anyone who was part of the guilty black race itself. This makes one realize we remain strangers to these people, sojourners, as were all our fathers." And that is just, it's such a load of racial essentialism and also these assertions with no evidence given. And also, I mean, that the last line in the extract where he talks about Indian people being sojourners is quite telling. He's saying Indians don't actually belong here. You know, they just come out from Asia to make some money and they're going to piss off. They're not actually South Africans, you know. So, and that's definitely the kind of thing we've got to stand against. And it's, yeah, it's quite worrying that these kind of people are comfortable to, saying this kind of bigotry. But, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised, especially from coming from the EFF. The EFF has been, from the beginning, it's been clear that they don't like white people. And we must not be same in any group that's based on kind of racism or bigotry. It doesn't just stop at one. It wasn't like the Nazis stopped where they just wanted to get rid of the Jews. No, they want to get rid of Slavs and, you know, people with mixed ancestry and black people and gypsies and whatever the case was. Same in South Africa. It wasn't only black people discriminated against. It was against everybody who wasn't white. Same in Cambodia. People, the Khmer Rouge, took on Vietnamese, took on people who could speak foreign languages. You know, bigotry doesn't just stop. Well, once bigotry started, it's a cancer. And you must make sure it doesn't, you must get rid of it completely. Just because bigotry is attacking whites, for example, doesn't mean it's okay or whatever. You know, bigotry is bigotry and must be stopped and it spreads.
Right, no, exactly. I also think it's kind of horrifying that, you know, like I can't imagine a white racist or someone or a white person writing something so unpleasant and racist as what you just read out being published in EWN. Mm. And I think it speaks to their low editorial standards.
Mm.
Anyway, Sarah, let's just quickly address the question of the charges here. So he's Jackie Chandu is being charged with inciting public violence and racial hatred.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of those charges? Do you think they're likely to stick based off of what you've read in the media?
I think. I think the, you know, to lay a charge again to the Equality Court, to the Human Rights Commission about hate speech would probably it would probably succeed for the state. Violence, I'm not so sure. It depends. I mean, words can be violent, but I depend on the specific circumstances, and I don't sort of know. I just know that he said these things. I don't know the circumstances in which he did.
No, I think it was outside a court at the time.
Well, you know, if it were like five people, I think one would have probably, you know. But it just strikes me that the ANC eThekwini and the EFF have done the DA a massive favor, because however many Indian voters there are in the country, they are now all voting DA.
Really likely, yeah. All right. I think let us move on to our next story, and that is the finance minister, Tito Mboweni, who, of course, runs Treasury. So Tito Mboweni has published a document saying that the national, or always said in public, that the National Treasury is developing new legislation which will, quote, seek to enhance the transformation imperatives of the South African financial sector. In answering a written parliamentary question, Mboweni said that a new version of the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill contains provisions that, if enacted, will require financial institutions to develop transformation plans and commitments around broad-based black economic empowerment. Mboweni said the Treasury had also recently published a draft policy document on financial inclusion for public comment. And at the same time, Employment and Labour Minister Tulas Nkosi has said that the government will need to introduce new regulations to speed up the rate of transformation at businesses in South Africa. Maurice, all the talk of economic reform and, you know, of Tito Mboweni being a reformer, something that I think I used to buy into, really doesn't seem that way. Black economic empowerment has not been terribly successful.
No, I mean, you can... South Africa now, I mean, there's also Mark Schussler just actually released some research he did. And now South Africans, after for most of the last century and early part of this century, were richer or as rich as the average global citizen. That's no longer the case. And according to Mark Schussler, apparently we now, average South African is only 40% about as rich as the average global citizen. So that tells you a couple of things. We've been going backwards while the rest of the world has been going past us. And the reasons for this is because we've been holding on to policies that simply don't work, and that, you know, they stuck in the last century of doing things. And I mean, the definition of insanity is doing something, doing the same thing, expecting a different outcome. And that's what happens, been happening in South Africa. We can talk about, you know, some people say there's a moral imperative for things like BE and whatever, and we can have that discussion, but it simply doesn't work. Inequality, if we break down inequality amongst just within the different races of South Africa, but the only racial group that saw its inequality increase over the past decade was Black South Africans. That's because BEE is only helping a small group of Black South Africans. People generally have access to resources or contacts for whatever reason, and we've seen inequality rise amongst amongst Black South Africans. We've also seen things such as unemployment increase amongst Black South Africans, particularly. I mean, it's been an issue for all South Africans, but it's been marked within amongst Black South Africans. And a lot of the policies we've been implementing and so on simply don't work. And we just keep doing the same stuff that simply doesn't work. And we've seen what the consequences are. Way more people who don't have jobs, way more people living in poverty, and all the other related social problems that come with those kinds of problems.
This is always the thing that strikes me, Sara, about BEE, is that it has been government policy very aggressively pushed for, about 20 years, roughly speaking now. And it has been an overriding objective in almost every single government department. If you sit through any government meeting, there will be some point or some section of any report which talks about, you know, deployment equity and gender balance of the workforce or racial balance of the workforce, whatever. It has been an absolute obsessive policy of the government. And it's weird for a government that's been doing it for 20 years to see so little results from it and say the solution is more of it.
Well, the thing is, I mean, the real hypocrisy, I actually can't believe it, of Tito Mboweni, because he actually understands more than most that BEE and similar processes are the biggest disincentive to foreign investors. Full stop. It's a big, because it's way too onerous. It usually involves giving half of your business away. And what I'd like to ask both him and Tula Sindezi, why? I mean, did you just go around counting and say, well, there are not enough black guys here and then too many white guys there? Did you ascertain whether there are not enough guys with the right skills? Are white employers being racist and therefore, won't allow black people to be employed at the right levels or whatever the right levels may be? Is it always white companies? I mean, are managements that are guilty of this not often mixed management? It's so, I can't think of the word for it, it's facile and it's nasty, because let's put it this way, the declining quality of South African education will have ensured that not as many black kids who came through the system in the last 20 years will necessarily have the skills that the business sector needs. And also there's also the thing of course that generally at management level, you're going to have probably a greater proportion of whites, although that's changing over time, than blacks, is simply because from the advantages of being white under apartheid, they will have progressed through the ranks over the time. I mean, nothing happens instantly. It takes you 10, 20, 30 years to get into senior management. And for black youngsters starting out, they're going up, but they're not getting there yet. So there's that element as well. So other than the fact that the program itself doesn't appear to work, it just doesn't we don't know actually if there's a problem, and if there's a problem, why it's a problem, and is it the fault of business that it's a problem?
Right. Maurice, any final thoughts on this topic?
I mean, the issue is, if we want racial representativity in our various sectors, that will also be a moving target, because as we all know, the white population is declining. So every year there'll always be, there's too many whites in the sector and whatever the case is. And just, I mean, it's just, you know, as I say, we can, some people say there's a moral imperative to have things like racial representativity, but one of the most vile aspects of apartheid was that people were classified by their race. And there was a golden period between 1990, I think it was actually 1991 and 1998, where there was no one race-based law on the statute books. But we've gone backwards. And we're actually going to, if the government carries on these quite onerous racial laws and so on, we're going to have to bring back something like the Population Registration Act. Because right now, there's no legal definition. What is a black South African? What is a white South African? What is an Indian South African? I can, in theory, now go say I'm a black South African when I fill in a form and so on. There's no, nobody can take a legal piece of paper and say, no, you aren't, because this is what a black South African is. So, I mean, we've actually had somebody who's done it, Glenn Steinman, the colored teacher down from Western Cape, classified himself as, said he was an African when he applied for a job as a headmaster instead of a colored South African. And the Western Cape Education Department actually took him to, wanted to take him to court before the charges were dropped. But, I mean, I don't want to encourage anybody to get to do anything that'll get them into trouble, but I do think maybe it is time for South Africans to start classifying themselves as a race different from what they're perceived as, because we either have to bring back apartheid-based legislation to say what people are, or we have to get rid of race-based legislation, one of the two.
Yes. Let us move on to our next topic for now. And because, of course, BE is something that we will return to. I see someone in the comments is suggesting that there's no way in South Africa where minorities dominate society on this level, and I would very strongly disagree with that. I think there's lots of historical examples, everything from Turkey in the beginning of the 20th century to Malaysia, where Chinese people make up disproportionate numbers of people in the upper echelons of society, Tutsis in Rwanda, Indians in Uganda. There's lots of examples like that. Anyway, let us move on. So we are going overseas now to talk about a bit of drama that's happened firstly with the Olympics, but also with the country Belarus. So as we covered on the show, I think last year, there were massive protests against the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, who has been president for a very, very long time in Belarus. He's effectively ruled it as a nearly unchallenged dictator. And some of his political opponents fled the country after the protest because it was a huge crackdown on them. These included a man called Vitaly Shishov. My Slavic pronunciation is not great. Who has just been found hanged in a park in Kyiv in Ukraine, where he had fled and been coordinating exiles from Belarus and finding them asylum. It was made to look like a suicide, but police are investigating it as a murder, and the implication is that someone aligned with Lukashenko murdered him. At the same time, a Belarusian Olympic sprinter said that she feared from her safety and that, that there was essentially an attempted kidnapping of her at the Tokyo Olympics, and that she refuses to go back to Belarus. She has now sought asylum with the Polish government, who have given her asylum. Maurice? What do you make of all this?
Well, it shows, I think, that the Belarusian regime is getting a bit, what's the word I'm looking for, belligerent. And, you know, who knows, this could maybe be, I think it's definitely something to watch. As far as I know, the Russians do support the Belarusians, or the Putin, I think he's an ally of Lukashenko. So, you know, this could be the kind of a flashpoint in Eastern Europe that could see to broader conflicts. But I think if we also, especially if we're seeing people now seeking asylum and defecting to, you know, for lack of a better word, the democratic West, you know, I think this is maybe a kind of an escalation in the relationship between the Belarusians and the democratic countries of Europe. But we've already seen that the Belarusians have, you know, been doing a lot of things that a lot of people would make them raise their eyebrows. I mean, there was that plane that they forced to come back to Minsk when it had that that anti-government blogger on, for example. So, yeah. And I think this fellow was killed now. I think it just shows that the Belarusians are, you know, the gloves are off now, I think, between and the Belarusians aren't going to, you know, play nicely with the protesters, even if they aren't in Belarus anymore.
Yeah, and it seems like a rising trend amongst autocracies around the world. So, of course, we've seen Rwandan dissidents murdered in South Africa. We've seen Russian dissidents murdered in the UK. And we've seen now Belarusians allegedly murdered outside of the country as well. Sarah, do you think this is becoming the new norms for autocrats, that they're showing they can reach people anywhere in the world?
It is, but I also suspect that the very fact that we are more aware of it and it's happening more often suggests that the regimes at issue are in a state of greater vulnerability. And so they're cracking down while they can. Look, I mean, obviously some of these guys can go on for years. I mean, Putin is one of them. Xi Jinping, China's another. But you always get the sense that the more public public an action of this nature is, that there's an element of desperation, impatience, anger. So it's one of those things, it's the opportunity for bad behavior gets greater, but the possibility that things might actually crumble becomes possible. I mean, Olympic athletes defecting, wow, that is very embarrassing. And so it must have annoyed Lukashenko enormously, because it's very public and it's a pride area. You know, it's about Belarusian skill, talent, etc. And the skill and talent wanted to get as far away from Belarus as possible. So it's interesting from that point of view. I'm not sure that it may not in the long run have some benefits in some places, but it's going to be damn ugly before that.
Yeah, no, very much agree with that. And let us end today with some good news. So firstly, Maurice, you wanted to talk a little bit about the Olympics.
Can't remember what I wanted to say about it. Just
sorry, it was Sarah. Sorry, I'm getting confused.
It wasn't, our best medal haul ever, but I was just watching a little news clip of Tatiana Skunwaka returning home, coming through the airport and hugging lots of fans. And I thought, that's great, breaching COVID, that's fine. It was fine in the circumstances, and her father was around and chatted to the press, and then she gave an interview standing there, and her father was standing to the side, and there was a side-on shot of her father watching her, and he had tears running down, well, his cheeks, I guess, because it was covered in a mask, but you saw these tears coming down from the corners of his eyes, and it was so sort of a father loves daughter moment. It was terribly, terribly sweet. And the name unfortunately escapes me at the moment, but I think we have to give some consideration to the to our runner who came
fourth in Sabine.
Sabine. I saw a shot of the moment when he and the leader of and the guy who came first crossed the line. It was literally half a foot difference between first and fourth. I mean, it was that close.
And remember, so, there's the three guys who won the medals, there's all around those times in personal bests. So all those guys had to run the fastest they've ever run in their lives to beat Tukani Simbine. So it tells you something about the kind of pace that that race was.
No, I mean, certainly watching it from the side, the actual, you know, the speed of the race ending, I could just tell that the guy who came first, but I couldn't tell who came second, third, or fourth. It was just that close. So it's actually an extraordinary achievement.
Mm. Then one. I'll add some, also one last bit of good news in is that the Springboks squared the series against the British Lions and British and Irish Lions on Saturday. Yes. So, and Rassie Erasmus seems to have got under their skin very nicely and the skin of the British press, which is always good to see. So let's hope they can wrap it up on Saturday and take it 2-1 for the Springboks.
So another piece of good news, which is unrelated to sport, because we, you know, most South African good news does come in the form of sport, is that the guy who was filmed, and there were things going around on social media, looting stuff from a Woolworths and then returning to his Mercedes-Benz, he was tracked down. He denied it was him. More footage emerged revealing it really was him. He has now pled guilty to several charges, including theft and public violence, in the Durban Magistrate Court. He's apparently a
day for justice.
Self-employed tenderpreneur who owns two vehicles and lives with his parents near Pinetown. Yes, well, I think it's good that someone who committed a crime is going to jail. I think I'll have
to say goodbye now because my colleagues have disappeared. So,
your internet's breaking. It's always good when someone goes faces the law and the system works. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching. We will see you tomorrow for the next episode of The Daily Friend Show. Have a wonderful afternoon and evening, everyone.